U današnjoj epizodi veliko mi je zadovoljstvo da predstavim našu gošću. U pitanju je Sara Kuburić, poznata na Instagramu kao Millennial Therapist, koja je izdala knjigu koja je dostupna na srpskom jeziku. Knjiga se zove Na meni je. I evo, pročitaću šta piše u ovaj opisu knjige. Prihvati okrutnu istinu, otkri sebe i promeni svoj život. Prilično, da kažem, ozbiljan taj tagline, ali evo, sada ćemo vidjeti šta je sve Saru inspirisalo, kako je došlo do stvari koje je pisala ovdje u knjizi i malo ćemo da sve to prokomentarišemo. Sara, prvo, evo, hvala što si došla kod nas. Meni je ovo bilo, baš sam se radovao ovom danu. Ja sam te na Instagramu pratio dosta dugo i onda kad sam video da si planirala da izdaš knjigu, uopšte nisam imao ideju da će doći ovaj moment da možemo mi zajedno da pričamo o tvojoj knjizi. Tako da sam baš srećan danas.
Hvala vam puno što ste me pozvali. I ja ću da pokušam pričati malo na srpskom, malo na engleskom, okay. Ali sam jako sretna što sam ovde i ćemo malo da pričamo o mojoj knjizi.
Okay. Znači samo da kažem našim gledalcima, svi delovi koji su na engleskom bit će naravno sada titlovani, tako da ćete moći da pratite. Ja ću Saru pitati tako, probat ću da pitam što više na srpskom, a onda kad budemo komentarisali malo ćemo se vratiti na engleski, tako da da znate da će biti tako, ali ponovo pominjem, bit će omogućeno svima da to mogu da isprate. Prvo što me zanima je to i tvoje ime na Instagramu Millennial Therapist. Kako si ga uopšte odabrala? Ja sam, nas dvoje smo ovde ponosni predstavnici milenijalske generacije. To je jedna od mojih omiljenih tema. Ja sam ovde u radnim epizodama dosta o tome govorio. Šta ti misliš da su glavne karakteristike milenijalaca i po čemu se, na primjer, razlikuju od generacije Z koja je došla posle njih?
Ime je bilo accidental.
Okay.
Znači, I was trying to figure out what my name should be, and I wanted people to know that I wasn't a normal therapist.
Okay.
And what I meant by that is most of my friends after grad school had gotten jobs at clinics, and they were living in one city, and I started traveling at that time. So I was in the Middle East, I was in Europe, and I was in all these places, and I wanted to signal to people that, like, yes, I'm a therapist, but also I have an unusual lifestyle that's very millennial. So a lot of people think the name is there because I'm speaking to millennials.
Okay.
But in reality, I actually chose the name because I am a millennial.
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah.
Yeah, of course, you're speaking to everyone. I understand that. But you mentioned traveling. Is that something you consider to be a defining characteristic of millennials?
Pa mislim da smo mi prva generacija koja to stvarno ozbiljno krenula da radi. I čak da radi i da putuje. Što moji barem roditelji ili prijatelji mojih roditelja i ta generacija nisu toliko puno radili. I ja mislim da taj nomad life je jedan deo te millennial lifestyle. I think what happened with millennials is that we broke all the social norms.
Okay.
We completely changed how people were meant to live their lives. We said we don't like the old script that our parents had. We ripped it up. We threw it away. And then we started to have this unusual way of existing. But the problem was that we didn't know how to do it. So we developed a new world and then had no blueprint for it.
Yeah, okay. I think that's very, very encouraging to hear because, on the internet, millennials are usually represented as, everybody jokes and they are always the target of the jokes because they are portrayed as,
lazy.
lost and, cannot find their place. They don't have no idea what they want to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. And, when I read about the differences between the millennials and Gen Z, what I found was the people who wrote the thought that millennials try to change the system from mm-hmm. within, and the Gen Z totally, even more radically, rip it apart, as you said. And there was one meme, it was how millennials and how Gen Z react when their boss asks them to work overtime.
Mm-hmm.
And the millennial said, sure, okay. And then goes home and calls mother and cries. And the Gen Z says, no way, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. So I think what I see as one of the biggest struggles for millennials is an identity crisis.
Okay.
And yeah. I think that's because all the structures that used to tell you who you were and how you should live your life are no longer there. Because we were like, we don't want that. But Gen Z, I'm finding, is more of an overall existential crisis where they have so much opportunity, so much freedom, that they're experiencing greater anxiety. Mm-hmm. They don't have the structure. And so they're you know, plummeting into these really huge existential crises at a super young age. And that's been like a really fascinating thing to watch.
Yeah, you mean like even at a younger age than us millennials?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
We're not young anymore.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, well, what you said, I spoke here already when we talked about millennials and when we talked about that, the thing that's called quarter life crisis,
yes.
You know, no more midlife, just, you know, as soon as you finish school, as soon as you're thrown into life, there's all a moment of complete, you know, this disorientation and loss of direction. And I already you know, I wrote an article in the newspaper we spoke about quarter life crisis, and mentioned that we don't have those structures, we don't have those strict societal norms which our parents said, which was, you know, you finish school, okay,
get married,
job, house, car, whole package. And maybe we are but what I wanted to say in that article is that maybe it has an upside, which is if we have quarter life crisis, maybe we won't have midlife crisis, you know, in the traditional sense that we, you know, paint our hair pink and, you know, buy convertibles and stuff like that, and, you know, tattoos at 50.
It's so interesting. I just am writing an essay about this where I think instead of calling it like a crisis, I almost call it a resuscitation. Because I think what happens to a lot of individuals in their mid-20s or 40s is that they realize that they're alive, but they're not living. And there's a difference between actually living your life. And so many of us get stuck with expectations and pressures or whatever guidelines we have chosen to follow. And then we realize that we're existentially quite numb and quite dead. And so this crisis for me is almost like a resuscitation to feel something, to feel anything. I don't think people are buying convertibles just for fun.
Yeah,
I think they want to feel the youth. They want to feel alive. They want to feel empowered. They want to feel important. And so for me, I think in order to actually avoid these crises, we need to constantly be engaging with life and making sure that we are feeling alive all the time.
Yeah, that sums it up pretty well. And one more comment about Gen Z, and then we'll move on to the book. You said that they're having a crisis at a very young age, and they have even less structure than we had.
Mm-hmm.
But what I noticed, and that's the situation in Serbia, so that's purely from my experience, is that they are somewhat more, I don't know, conservative or traditional than millennials. I don't know if it's like that in the West. Yeah. I think there's a you know, returning to some of the old values and some, and that the millennials remain the most progressive generation here.
Wow, that's so interesting. Ne bih rekla da tako u Americi. Ja još uvijek mislim da Gen Z, they're pushing every boundary. Svaku granicu koju mogu da gurnu, oni još uvijek guraju. Mislim da ćemo uskoro vidjeti the swing back to conservative sort of lifestyle, because we're going to overcorrect. But right now, the Gen Z population, at least from like the North American perspective, is still pushing way past what we did.
Yeah, okay. Well, ovo ću sad na srpskom, pošto mi je malo teže, ali svakako ima i toga. Ali nekako da pored, na primjer, vidim za te neke stvari, recimo, ranije dobijaju decu i ranije se ove žene nego moja generacija, kad kažem ljudi 7-8 godina mlađi od mene. A druga stvar, to što si rekla, to je to toliko guranje do jedan ekstrem da se u stvari samo u jednom truku obrne novčići, to bude u stvari isto. I da zapravo sada imamo jednu, da kod njih da nazovem najšire moguće, ultralevičarsku ili ultradesničarsku poziciju, a to su maltene, mislim, isti ljudi. Isti profili ljudi su na te dve ove grupacije, neko vidim. E sad, Gen Z su i dalje adolescenti, pa to je, mislim, i sastavni deo adolescencije, taj neka sklonost ka ekstremima, pa ćemo vidjeti kako će biti kada oni potpuno sazru.
Da, mislim, mi sad trenutno u Americi imamo puno konverzacija o non-monogami i open relationships. I sad skoro da kažeš da si monogamous,
Nije više popularno.
Pa ne da nije popularno, you're not enlightened anymore. Tebi
da.
Kao ti ne shvataš sebe, ni život, ni ništa. Tako da smo mi u nekoj fazi gdje ljudi beže od bilo šta je bilo tradicionalno. I ja mislim da će you know, there will be Gen Zers who start getting married at 20, but right now I'm not really seeing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now we'll move on to the book. And first, mm-hmm. I want to ask you the title of the book. How did you come up with it?
Painfully. I think the title is sometimes the hardest part.
Yeah, of course. Every time, I think.
Yeah. So, I think what is really important to me is the message of responsibility. Oh, okay. And I noticed that throughout the book, I would say the phrase, it's on me, or it's on us. And so one of my editors was like, hey, you say this all the time. Mm-hmm. Why don't you make that the title? And I kind of like it. It's a bit provocative.
Okay. It is. It's, you know, that the call to responsibility is sometimes hard to hear, but I think it's... in the end, very encouraging, mm-hmm. because it's better when it is on us than being controlled by some powers we can't influence in any way. The theme of the book is the loss of self and finding yourself again, and this ties to the conversation before about finding your place in the world. But before we dive into the loss of self, I'd like to discuss about what the self is. It's one of the, now used, very much used in literature and in general public term. But what is the difference between self, between identity, between personality? Yeah. Are those the same? Are there any differences? And of course, the question of being authentic self, because I think authentic is now being one of the most misunderstood terms.
Yes.
Yeah. And... used in advertising, buy this product and you will be your authentic self. So, now everybody wants to be authentic, but they all want to be authentic in the same way.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I love that. Well said. So the self is a very, debated concept from philosophy to psychology to probably medicine. And I have a very unsexy definition of the self. And that is, the self is an accumulation of choices, responsibility, and freedom. The self is essentially whatever you create it to be. Now, there is a lot out there on social media that talks about finding yourself. Mm-hmm. And I find that terminology quite problematic. To me, that's essentialism, not existentialism. Mm-hmm. So to make that distinction, very briefly, or
sure.
unless you want to make that distinction.
Yeah.
Is essentialism believes that you are given an essence and then you exist.
Yeah.
While existentialism believes that you exist and then you create your essence. So, thinking to yourself, like, do I believe there is someone I was meant to be? Where does that come from? Who gave me this identity or sense of self? And then you either are going to succeed at becoming that or fail.
Okay.
That's essentialism.
Okay, yeah.
Existentialism goes... you actually exist and you can be whoever you want to be. There are limitations and we can talk about that later. But I like it because it's saying you are how you show up in the world. And so for me, the self is just kind of a byproduct of your choices and the responsibility and the way you choose to use your freedom.
Yeah, that you what you said now is one of my favorite parts of the book.
Oh.
Throughout the book, okay, so for our viewers, the book has 10 chapters and we will discuss some of them, and every chapter ends with one hard truth and one gentle reminder. Mm-hmm. Is like that in English, because I write in Serbian.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. So the hard truth is something that calls us to be responsible, to be, masters of our own lives, and the gentle reminder is just a hug which helps us to swallow and digest the hard truth. And the hard truth that I like the most is the one which I will read now. It's, I think, after first chapter, and that's like my favorite part of the book.
Oh,
okay.
Thanks. It's all downhill from there.
Yeah, no. Evo, pročitaću na srpskom, pa evo, znači, onaj ko si u ovom trenutku, bilo to u avionu, za kuhinskim stolom ili u krevetu, jeste ono što stvarno jesi. Ako ti se ta osoba ne sviđa, na tebi je da učiniš nešto po tom pitanju. Mm-hmm. And that's the point you were trying to make, and it's very beautifully written here, is that if we go down this existentialist path, you cannot find your true self, you have to create your true self.
Yeah, how empowering is that,
though?
Very. How cool, how playful, how... liberating. To me, I know namenie seems intense. Mm. Saying like you have to create seems intense, but it's not meant to be filled with blame or I don't know, fear. It's actually supposed to be liberating and hopeful. And that's the way that I see the title and even that statement. Yeah.
Do you know the show BoJack Horseman?
No.
It's an animated show on Netflix.
Okay.
It's the main character is a horse mm-hmm. who is... those are, you know... human-like animals who speak and everything, and he's a washed-up actor who was famous for some sitcom 20 years ago, and now he's alcoholic and self-destructive and stuff like that. It's a very, very good show because even though it seems silly, it's actually very dark and very, very emotional, and he's struggling with the question of is he a good person?
Mm.
And he asks his friend, am I a good person deep down? And she says something like, I don't remember exactly, but it's something like this. She says, I don't believe in deep down. What you do is who you are.
Mm, so good.
Yeah.
I believe that too.
Yeah. And how do you define authentic?
So I don't know if many people know this, but authenticity came from Heidegger.
Okay.
So Martin Heidegger, Being in Time, love that book. Love him as in the thoughts that he brought forth. And there's a German word for authenticity, which I will not try to pronounce because it's so hard.
Yeah, I could if I had it because I learned German in school.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
But I don't know it very well, but I can read. You know, I can pronounce. I
cannot pronounce. I remember doing an audio recording of my book and we had to do that part like 10 times for me to pronounce it. But what I love about that word, when you translate it, it means to own one's own or ownness. What does that sound like to you?
Sounds complicated and philosophy-like, but
yes. It's responsibility.
Yeah, of course. But how is the term authentic how did it become so misused and misunderstood?
I think authentic was supposed to, the way I summarize it is an authentic decision is a decision you choose to take responsibility for. And I think what happened was there is something so integral about that, so pure, so aligned. And then I think over time it became like an excuse, you know, when people go and do something really horrible or are really mean to someone, they go, well, I was just being authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like an excuse.
It's like an excuse, which is so interesting because the original translation is responsibility for your action. And now it's being used as an excuse. And I honestly don't know when that transition mm-hmm. happened. Like, when did authenticity mean you feel good all the time? Mm-hmm. You like being authentic? Like, that's so misdirectional. Like, I think it gives people a false promise because I think being authentic is hard. I think it's uncomfortable. I think sometimes it can even hurt, like, you know, your pride, mm-hmm. you have to apologize. And so I think we're completely misunderstanding the concept. And now it just means like, do whatever you feel like doing and whatever feels good. And that, I think, is really dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the part that I mentioned about being used in advertising, it's sort of like, you know, the part about finding your true self. It's also,
yes.
It seems like a shortcut, you know, own this or be that and you will
buy
find
this
yourself.
Book. Yeah. And you, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, of course. So you said being authentic is hard, it's uncomfortable, but okay, why should we do it?
Because it's worth it. I think it's really hard to describe to someone what it feels like to own yourself or to be able to stand behind your decisions or when you look in a mirror to truly respect and know who that person is. I think when you get a taste of that empowerment and that like groundedness, there is nothing that compares to that feeling. And I think, you know, when I make mistakes, which I do because I'm human, there's something really great about being like, that's my mistake. That was my own doing. I wasn't just a victim to life. And I find it so invigorating. And I think you're going to have a more fulfilled. I think the only way to have a fulfilled or meaningful life is to have an authentic life. So why do it? Because you want your life to mean something.
Yeah. Okay. Sold.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned existentialism, so I think we can now come back to it. It's okay, you better explain it and then I'll tag along. What does existentialism mean to you? Why did you, how did you become drawn to it, and how did you choose to you know, choose it as something you do as your, you know, life's work, I think, and why is it so, you know, universally relatable? It's, you know, most of our, those people, we will talk about the great authors, they lived over 100 years ago, and the society's changed so much since then, and then, and those messages are so, so relevant even now.
Yeah. So I think existentialism, people are like, I understand existentialism. It's a bunch of old white dudes who really suffered and had a lot of questions about life. And I understand therapy, but I don't understand them together. And the way I like to describe it is, think about going to any therapist. When you sit in front of them, they need to understand what's going on for you. They need to conceptualize what your pain looks like, and then how they're going to help you get to your goal. So if you're going to someone like a CBT therapist, or let's take an attachment theory therapist, they're going to listen to your story, and they're going to pick out what attachment you have. And then they're going to work on that attachment, or CBT, they're going to look at your thoughts and your behaviors. As an existentialist, I look for responsibility. I look for authenticity. I look for isolation, meaning, death. Really intense, universal topics. So that's how existentialism helps me understand what is happening for the client, and then how to get them to the goal that they want. For me personally, in my early 20s, I had kind of a breakdown, an unraveling. And I was in the midst of my graduate program, and I was studying about all these different modalities. And it was kind of a fun thing to test on myself, to be like, does this resonate? Does this work? Do I find this helpful? And the answers were just no. Not because the tools weren't good, but because I didn't feel like those theories understood me. And then I stumbled upon existentialism. And there's like, I think it's in the book, of one of the first things I ever read about an existential therapist was them trying to work with a suicidal client.
Yeah.
And then going, okay, I hear why you want to kill yourself. Cool. So here's a question. Why don't you kill yourself? And I remember just reading that and being like, am I allowed to say this? And my mind was blown, because he was being provocative, but really what he was asking is, why are you choosing to live? And I needed someone to ask me that question at that time. And so I just felt really understood. And there was something very comforting about that.
Yeah, and you know, one of the great works of existential therapy, the Viktor Frankl's The Man's Search for Meaning, do you know how it's translated here in Serbia?
No.
It's called Zašto si niste ubili.
No, yeah, is it really?
That's the title of the book here, yeah.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that. I love that.
Yeah, what I wanted to ask you is, you know, existentialism, a bunch of old white dudes, but so how does the things that those old white dudes said 100 years ago, how is it still relevant? I mean, that this goes to the topics of isolation and loss. Did people always feel this isolated, and did always this lost?
I think what existentialism does so well is it targets inherently human questions and problems. And so, I mean, they're all philosophers, and I think philosophers are incredibly intelligent individuals. And what they do more often than not is ask questions. They might not provide answers, but they ask a lot of great questions. And so for me, they were just observing humanity in its most pure form and asking questions that, you know, over time ended up just being relevant in every single generation. But I think that's because it's inherently human to struggle with all of these things that are now considered existential concepts.
Mm. Yeah, well, when I hear existentialism or think about it, my first association is always, you know, the questions of the meaning of life, you know, and how they approach it. And I think you covered it when you said about, you know, what makes you you. I think it's quite the same when you talk about what's the meaning of life. It's not given to you, and you create it. And but it's still, for many people, it's still so hard to accept it, that there is, you know, no inherent meaning, no universal meaning.
Of course, and some might even disagree with it. Yeah. I think the thing for me in the book, I knew I couldn't give people answers. Okay. because everyone has to come to their own answer. So what I try to teach people is how to ask these questions and how to seek their own answers. Because I think when you're looking for a universal stamp of approval, like Sarah's going to tell me who I am, Sarah's going to tell me why to live my life, we're in trouble. And I hope that as you go through life, you don't give anyone that much power to fully mold your existence. It should be your job.
Yeah, of course. But okay, so when we talk about the loss of self you mentioned in the book, maybe we could begin by you describing how do we find out if we have lost ourselves. Okay. Yeah. So
So if someone asks you who are you and you can't answer that question, great sign. Ali mayosh puno. Na primer, if you can't make decisions and you really struggle making decisions, that could be a sign that you're struggling with your sense of self because you have no ground on which to make the decision. It would be like saying, pick the best gift for this child, and you have never met the child. You don't know how old the child is. You don't know what the child likes. You don't know if the child struggles with anything. You're supposed to pick the best gift. So that's kind of why it's so hard for us to sometimes make informed decisions and we get overwhelmed is because we don't know what we're basing it on. Then there's moments, and I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but you do something and then you go, what did I just do? Like, I do not recognize this person that just did that. And it feels like out of body experience, like there's another form of you that's doing something completely different. So having patterns in relationships or constantly molding to become who your partner wants you to be is another sign that you have a, weak sense of self. And so there are so many. I think this is why it's such an interesting concept, is because the way that it manifests is holistic.
Okay, I think that those questions are very good, and I think our viewers will, I hope they will ask themselves those questions. I don't know, you asked me if it did that happen to me, that I do something and then, wow, what was that? Not that much, but the first one really resonated with me, inability of making decisions, which I spoke about it here in some episodes, inability of, choosing what to do with my free time, when there are lots of options and there is no, I like to watch movies, I like to play video games, I like to listen to music, I like to play tennis. Mm-hmm. And so how do I choose between these on a today, I have 3 hours today, and how do I pick it? Mm-hmm. And I'm not proud of it, but sometimes I, go to my computer and go to that randomizer and so let it.
I love it. Good for you.
Okay, so what did you find to be, the common reason? Why do people lose themselves?
Yeah, so I talk about several reasons. Okay. One is a life-altering event.
Okay.
So this can be a trauma or a car accident, or it can be a medical diagnosis, or a life-altering event can be moving to a new country or becoming a parent. So what happens is you have like pre-event self, post-event self, and you don't know how to integrate them.
Okay, yeah.
And this is often what kind of causes some of that disconnect, or if you get a diagnosis, you're ashamed, you don't want to have a relationship with yourself. If you experience some type of trauma, oftentimes disconnect is a very common consequence. The second way that it occurs is family rules or modeled behavior. So I'm not really sure why we're expecting to know for people to know how to be authentic if their parents have not practiced or shown them how to do that. Or if their parents never taught them about freedom or responsibility or choice and instead imposed who they should be and how they should act and micromanaged them. So now they don't have even the skills to really become themselves. And so that's another way that we tend to lose ourselves. And then the third one is self-betrayal, which is, I kind of talk about it as lack of loyalty to yourself and putting people or things or goals or external anything above who you are. And little by little, it's almost like you turn on music here, and then in this room, every time that you don't do something that aligns, you take a step back. take a step back, and eventually you're not going to hear the music. And that's kind of the metaphor of like self-loss.
Okay, well, if you'd like, we could discuss all of those points. I think it's very, very interesting.
It's a lot.
No, yeah, it's a lot, no, of course. But what I wanted to say about, you know, life-altering events, they happen to everybody, you know.
Of course.
It's of course, not everyone will be equally, you know,
impacted
by a single event, whether it be, you know, what you said. Some things, those events aren't necessarily bad. And
totally,
everything that really, really changes your life. And so we're all at risk of, you know, losing our sense of self. So we need to, I think, practice awareness and, you know, to be on alert. Well, it sounds dramatic, on alert, but,
no,
you know,
but I think it's true.
You need to be perceptive of what happens around you. I just, you know, we don't need to discuss it some more. I just wanted to share my associations about family rules. That it's extremely interesting to me because, you know, the example in your book about one of the most, you know, impactful examples of therapy is with the young woman who struggles with family rules, who came to you with a message with there was a, you know, set of rules that the father sent, and they all need to reply that they agree with the rules. And she's like, I don't know, 30 something, near 40 years old, and she still has to, you know, comply, or at least pretend to comply to the rules. And what I would like to add is sometimes, and it's something I've experienced and seen in my environment, is that, you know, those strict and, how do I say it, you know, obvious family rules, which are you know, visible for everyone, you can rebel maybe easier. But there are also some rules which are, you know, subtle and like subtext and something that's not spoken, but it's...
Footnotes.
Footnotes which really can influence you, and it's much harder to become aware of those rules. And I think it's one of the you know, things that you know, clients have the most progress in therapy, when they become aware of those rules that are somehow, those are, you know, family rules, but also the rules of a broader culture. Everything is so implicit, and you don't think about it, but it's there.
Yeah.
And it can definitely, you know, steer you away from your sense of self. And of course, self-betrayal in the end. What you wrote about in the book, which I liked very much, was, you know, the self-betrayal that happens in relationships. It's that eternal question: how much compromise is okay? How do I, you know, adapt? Because we do need to adapt, and we do need to belong. And how do I adapt and not lose myself? And it's so hard.
So hard. I mean, anyone who's been in any kind of relationship, not even just romantic, will understand how hard that is. And I don't, this is kind of like a hot take, I don't think compromise is really that great.
Okay.
I think oftentimes what ends up happening is you have two people that didn't get what they want because they have met in the middle. And at the same time, I think compromise is necessary. So the question is not, do I compromise or do I not compromise? The question is, what do I compromise on?
Okay.
So compromising on preferences, even wants, to a healthy extent, totally normal. Do we go out and eat Italian food or Chinese food? That is probably not going to impact your sense of self. You're probably okay, and you can have the Chinese food if they want to, right? But compromising on needs, boundaries, values, beliefs, that's when the problem ensues.
But, you know, usually in relationships, you know, people who betray themselves, they are more than ready to compromise those things.
Of course, because they want to be loved and they want to be seen and they want to be appreciated. And I have so much empathy because I've been there. I was that person. That being said, is if someone loves you for not you, you're not going to feel loved. This is a lesson I had to learn. You will only feel loved if you truly show yourself and they still choose you. Yeah. So at some point, I think we have to come to that point to be like, I might lose you, but you know what's scarier than losing you? Losing myself.
Mm. Yeah, we have to be willing to take the risk.
We have, you know, to. There's no love without risk. Yeah.
If we show ourselves for who we really are, there's always a risk that the other person will say, okay, I don't want it.
Exactly.
But it's the only way.
It is literally the only way. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We spoke to those are personal events which we spoke about and how they influence the loss of self. But does society play a role? I know it does.
Do
but
you know
I
the answer?
Say
yeah. Yeah, I think society plays a huge role. I think another misconception kind of with authenticity as well is it's an isolated experience. Like you can go into a cave or you can journal in your room for days and then emerge as your authentic self. And there is no self without the other. This is something I truly believe. And Heidegger talks about that concept of like being in the world. I think because the self only exists when it's expressed.
Okay.
This is really philosophical.
Yeah, but it's right? Pretty much, you know, you can maybe think about it in an intuitive way. It feels right.
It feels right. And so there is no self without self-expression. So you are really, really entangled with the world. There is no distinguishing you from the world necessarily. And you're always going to be molded by the world to some extent. So something I talk about in the book, again, is where do you find your freedom? Where do you find your choice? And where do you find your responsibility within society? So let's say that someone you hang out with will impact your beliefs, how you feel about yourself, your emotions, your thoughts, whatever. Your choice is to choose who that person is. And so what happens in society oftentimes is we have this perception of who we are. And then our society says, no, that's not you. And then you are really confused, or your friends go, no, that's not you. I don't know if you've ever had a friend describe you in a way that is not how you would have described yourself or a stranger. And it's really shocking and disorienting. And so that's where it becomes an issue, because sometimes you will have people mirror back to you someone you're not. And it's about finding individuals who are A, open to actually seeing you for who you are, and B, you can trust will reflect back to you. And now you're not always going to like what they say. Okay. And sometimes they're right. And we need those reality checks. But I think what's more dangerous is to look for someone to be a mirror who is imposing who they want you to be rather than actually reflecting who you are. So society plays a huge role in why we're lost and how it perpetuates that loss.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm thinking now it's not that easy to make a distinction between when someone says something about you that you don't like.
Yeah,
it's not always easy to say, hey, this is what, you know, he imposes on me. And the other option is he's my real friend and he tells me something I need to know. So how can we differentiate between those two?
I think one is trust. I mean, if you really trust someone, you're very close with someone. I think that's one of the ways to be like, okay. And the second is to be honest with yourself, to really practice self-honesty, to go, am I offended because I'm triggered because I don't want to see this truth because he's saying something I've been avoiding for so long? Or is he saying something that's so shocking and doesn't align at all? Being triggered is not the same as just because you're triggered doesn't mean they're wrong.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, of course, and often it means exactly the opposite. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, because if something feels, you know, emotionally very charged and very powerful, it probably has a reason.
There.
Yeah, it's not just made. No, came out of thin air.
Exactly, and it doesn't mean they're right, but they hit something.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. And, you know, this is what I wanted to ask you some time ago, but I forgot. And it's in the book. And you say that there are, and I think that this will be interesting for people to ask themselves about. You said there are people who lose themselves somewhere along the way and the people who never had a true self.
Mm-hmm.
So is okay. So the first question is, how can we never have ourselves? And the other is, is it important in the end? Which category are we in?
So no. Okay, there's absolutely no difference if you knew who you were and then you lost it versus you never knew, because the point is you're lost right now and that loss is going to feel pretty similar. Now, actually, sometimes I think it's harder for individuals who did know and lost it, because often what they try to do is go back.
Yeah. And there's no going back.
So it's almost this false safety they have. And they're like, if only I could be how I was before, blah, blah, blah. And then they try so hard and it's never going to be authentic because your authentic self can never be found fully in the past. And so individuals who've never developed their sense of self, that's very possible. Think about the society we live in now.
Yeah.
So unless someone modeled it to them, unless they were taking that responsibility, that freedom, they're not going to just all of a sudden do it. And so I meet a lot of individuals that never really solidified or even asked themselves that question to like their 20s or 30s.
I think the more often the case is that people have no idea who they are and they never had it. Maybe
exactly.
They had it as children.
Yeah.
And because there were no, it wasn't that complicated. And now when they become adults, when they grow up, those questions you mentioned them in the beginning, you know, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
It's so hard to answer that question. You mentioned in the book somewhere that, you know, write who something about who you are and use 50 words.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, pretty hard
everyone
for everyone.
Everyone brings
yeah.
that up. Yeah, everyone's like, that was impossible. Yeah. And I was like, I make my clients do that all the time.
Yeah, and I think that we are, that's one of the things we mix are our sense of self with some identity we have or some role we play, and you're right about it also. We tend to see ourselves only through the lens of the role we play. So if you said, I'm Sarah, I'm a psychologist or therapist, and we see only that, and it's not enough.
It's not enough, but it's interesting. It happens all the time, I'm sure, for you as well as a professional. A lot of people just know you as the professional.
Yeah, of course.
And so it's so interesting to have only that reflected back to me. Let's talk about society reflecting, because all they reflect back is like a very little piece of me. And then I have to get others to reflect the fact that I am, you know, a friend and a daughter and a sister and all these things to feel fully seen. And so I think for a young professional, it's really easy to over-identify with that role. And it's like those therapists who always speak like therapists to everybody because they're like really, they are a therapist. And mothers, for example, that's a huge one when you become a mother because it takes up so much of your time.
Yeah, I love that example from the book about the mother. Yeah, I wasn't going to mention it because I forgot, but now I am. You spoke about a young mother on TikTok who is making videos, and someone commented, if I remember correctly, being a mother is not a personality, and she was so offended. And so what do you think about it?
So I understand why for her, it goes back to the self-expression. If all she does all the time is express herself only as a mother, that would become to feel like her entire sense of self. I think the other person was trying to point out you're taking this role way too seriously and there are other aspects of you that you're ignoring right now. And that's really hard to say to a mother. And I don't even know if that's an appropriate or a kind way to say that. But I do think it happens to all of us where we go, okay, here are two things that I'm doing right now and that's all that I am. And then, for example, your work becomes your identity, then you lose your job. During COVID, when people couldn't work, and that was their sense of identity, we saw a huge spike in identity crises because they had absolutely no idea who they were outside of work.
Yeah, but the thing about the mother, which this is just my own thinking, and what happens is if you already had a weak sense of self, you're probably more susceptible to have one role take over everything. And if you had a strong sense of self, then you could more easily integrate those new roles without losing everything else.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned COVID and identity crisis, and identity crisis is one of the buzz terms, nowadays. And this isn't from the book. This is all some of my own interests. Do you think that the identity crisis the young people are going through is in any way connected to the overabundance of choices everywhere? Because we talked about it in some of the earlier episodes. You know, it's in every area in our life, we have so many choices and so much freedom, much more than ever before. And it's so hard to navigate, you know. Take reading, for example. It's supposed to be something you love and you go to university or study, and maybe 30, 40 years ago, they would say you find those books and you will find them, maybe mm-hmm. struggle to find some. Mm-hmm. And now you have every book ever written in English mm-hmm. here. You know, you need 2 clicks and you can buy it or, you know, find it anywhere in any other form. So how do you choose? You know, everything is so confusing and so disorienting, you know. Dating culture also, you know, there's so many choices.
You're swiping on an app. It's like you're shopping.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And there is no, you know, when there's so many choices, you're always left wondering, did I make the right choice? Because you don't have any.
Better?
Yeah. And you don't have any criteria to find. You know, I was speaking with a colleague about, you know, about relationship. Maybe if you lived, you know, 50 years ago in some town, you know, mid-sized, you have a limited choice of available potential partners. And then I don't think that means you have to find a partner there, but you will choose one and maybe you will learn what you like about them, what you don't. Maybe in the relationship ends, you pick another one. And now we don't give each other time to learn what we'd like.
No, and also, you know, you'll hear stories like, I went on a date and I will never see them again. I'm like, oh my gosh, what happened? I really didn't like the color of their sweater. Like, it's really, it's as if it's a product that's supposed to be custom made for mm-hmm. you. But then to your point, you don't even know what you want it to look like. So people are going in and just being like, I'm just going to see how I feel. It's like, yes, your feelings should definitely be a part of it. But you cannot get a partner that works for you if you don't know who you are. Because who is this partner dating? And again, it goes with the multiple choices. Like, how are you going to make a choice about a partner or what you do in your free time if you don't know who is making that decision? And so dating has become completely chaotic, but also really unrealistic. People are expecting perfection and people are always thinking there's so many other opportunities. What if there's something better out there? And I have clients talk to me about that all the time. Like, Sarah, how can I be happy and content if there's, like, I don't know, 100 other guys I could be going out with, and what if they're a better fit?
And what do you say?
That's what, come to therapy and I'll tell you.
Yeah, well, I think that we all struggle with it because we are, you know, growing up in that culture. And I really don't have an answer when people ask me, you know, how do you choose? How do you choose which book to read or what movie to watch? There is no answer. You just try. You just try and live with it.
Yeah. It's like, take responsibility for a choice you make. There is no ultimate right decision. I think there's a lot of beliefs that are making us stressed out when making decisions. But what if there's multiple partners that work for you? What if 100 books would be really good to read? What if, and just realizing that you're going to ultimately make a choice for the one that aligns with you at that point, and there might be others, but you're okay with the choice that you made.
Yeah. And this discussion about choices leads us back to one of the great existential themes, and it's mm-hmm. the theme of, you know, death and not having enough time, you know, and that's, I think, a huge part of it. You said every book you choose is you close the door on other books, and everything you commit to means you won't have enough time for everything else. And I think it's people really struggle to come to terms that it's okay not to experience everything.
Yeah. I think every choice comes with grief, because you're grieving everything that you couldn't do, or previous versions of yourself, or people you've ended relationships with. And so that's what we also have to just become okay with. I think we're so avoidant of any kind of suffering or discomfort. And I think it's why we're becoming increasingly more impulsive. But, like, it's okay to suffer as a human. Like, not extensively, not chronically, but it's okay to feel sad and uncomfortable and dislike something. So I think people need to realize there's so much grief in decision making. And I find death super liberating.
How so?
Because ultimately you're going to die. And it doesn't matter what book you read.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Course.
Like, there's something really nice about that, where it's like we take life so seriously. And I think we don't take a lot of responsibility, but it should be the other way around.
Yeah, take responsibility, but
play with it.
Play with it, yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, we mentioned Viktor Frankl, and he always used humor as one of the, you know, main remedies for the, you know, seriousness of life and for the tragedies of life.
Yeah. Even, like, he's so cheeky. Like, he's so cheeky about everything. I think at the start of his book, there's someone asked him, how do you differentiate logotherapy, which is his therapy, to psychoanalysis?
Yeah, tell us, please.
And he goes, well, before I answer, can you please describe what psychoanalysis is? And I think the person, I'm paraphrasing, the person said something like, well, in psychoanalysis, you know, you lay down and you have to say things that you don't really want to say and that are a little uncomfortable and scary. And he goes, well, you know, in logotherapy, you can sit up, but you're going to hear things you don't want to hear. And I absolutely love that because he's being so cheeky, so playful, and also defining the therapy very accurately. But I love it. He always finds ways to just kind of make light of the situation. When that question, if you ask a professional, they can take it so seriously, get so defensive, give the exact differences. He was like, hey, we're just going to... Okay. We're just going to do this.
We're just going to talk about something and maybe you won't like it at the time, but it's going to be good for you. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, he was always, provocative and always, you know, takes little jabs at you and says how, you know, then looks at how you will react and how you will respond. And then that's an information that's important.
Of course. I love it.
Speaking about death, very, very cheerful subject, yeah. Of course, I think that, as you said, if you don't have that mentality which you described as that it's liberating, there are definitely, you know, bad sides to dying. But of course, if you think only about those bad sides, I think life is completely unbearable.
It's scary.
Yeah, very scary.
Yeah.
But it should be scary sometimes. That's sure. What I like to say. You know, lots of people that I'm in contact with completely avoid the subject like it's something that you must never talk about dying. Never. Mm. Or won't acknowledge that they have a fear of dying. And I think, do you think it's possible not to have a fear of dying?
I think it would be strange to have no resistance to non-existence.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, I think there's two categories of people. People who are scared of not existing and can't fathom non-existence. And those who are actually scared of the process of death. So will it be painful? Will it be slow? But I think everyone, it would kind of be an odd evolutionary thing not to have anything, any resistance to not existing.
Yeah, but what I read in a book some time ago, which I really liked, and it's by an existential philosopher, but quite modern. His name is Carlo Sprenger.
Oh, this is
from Switzerland. Yeah. And he spoke about, you know, us people, we don't have the awareness of our mortality in our day-to-day lives because it would be impossible to live if we thought about it all the time.
Yes.
But when something happens, when someone we know dies or some accident happens or something, then we are briefly put in something he described like an acute state of, you know, being aware of your mortality. Mm-hmm. And he describes those moments as powerful, you know, potential moments of potential change.
Yeah.
And those are the moments where you can redefine your life and find new meanings. But you can't think about it all the time.
No, but if you didn't have death, you probably wouldn't find life very meaningful. It's like, here is all the pizza you can eat all the time. Or here is, if something is infinite, we stop seeing value in it. And so as humans, yes, death scares us, but it's also something that makes the fact we're alive mean something.
Yeah, that's very well said.
Thanks.
Okay, so what I wanted to talk about next is we spoke about being in a society. You know, you can't escape from it. You are. What I before the question, what I found quite common in people who begin, you know, reading lots of psychological literature, begin understanding, working on themselves, they sometimes get lost in their own minds. And that's the part of their life that goes missing, is the interaction with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, we cannot, the self doesn't exist without the other.
Mm-hmm.
So what I liked about the book is that you didn't promise people, hey, you can be yourselves and you don't need any validation from others, because it's, you know, completely impossible.
Yeah.
So the great question is, how do we find balance in that? How do we, you know, fulfill our need to belong, which we all have, and to protect ourselves?
Yeah. So I think it's all about balance. I think your internal validation always needs to be at the forefront. And then obviously you need external validation. So again, it's who are you choosing to validate you?
Yeah, of course. That's the thing that, about choice, about always having choice. We cannot force other people to validate us, but we can choose whose opinion, whose judgment we care about.
And it's really great to choose people you want to be more like, people you respect, people who you think are living a life that inspires you or challenges you. And I think that's how we should make our selection, rather than popularity or convenience.
Yeah, and that also illustrates the need for other people. You know, you can't just, I'm going to go to my room and I'm going to read all the books and do some exercises and now I know who I am and nothing anyone says will ever affect me.
Well, I always say, okay, imagine you're like, Sarah, I'm so patient. And then you give me a ride and you're honking and you're swearing and you're really upset in that moment. And I go, hey, you're looking real upset. You're not very patient. You have two options, because now the self is expressed. Now the self actually exists. Before, it was just in your head.
Yeah.
So you have two options. One is to change your narrative, to go, hey, I'm not actually patient. And now your actions and your words align. Great. Your thoughts align with your actions. Awesome. The second option is to change your action. And you go, you know what? You're right. And the next time you drive and someone cuts you off, you take a deep breath and you don't do anything. Yeah. And so I think that's kind of the, you get tested all the time and you get to pivot and change and edit. And that's also fun too.
Yeah. I didn't swear and honk, by the way.
No, actually, he was a lovely driver. Did not get upset at all. Yeah. Just to...
Yeah, and you know, when we talk about our relationship with others and with the world, one of the important subjects that comes up in the book is the question of boundaries. So, also very popular theme. And
yes.
How would you describe what healthy boundaries are? Why do we need them? How do we make them?
Yeah, so boundaries to me are an outline of the self. So I think a lot of people see them as walls, and I see them as blueprint. And then I take it a step further and go.
Blueprint was interesting. I didn't expect it.
So blueprint is kind of like, I'm telling you where the window is, where the door is, where the wall is. I'm telling you exactly where you can't enter and where you can enter and where it's easy to enter and where it's hard to enter. So I'm giving you everything you need in order for us to have a healthy relationship. And you can do with that as you wish. Now, you can try to break through my walls, in which case we're going to have issues and I'm going to distance myself. But I told you that that wall existed. And I like it, because what it does, it's like, I want you to succeed in having a relationship with me. So I'm giving you a blueprint of my house. How cool.
Yeah.
Instead of, I'm just putting up a lot of walls because I'm scared, because you're going to hurt me, because of... So I think your boundaries should really be contextual. They should be flexible in terms of, you know, different people, different times. And I think that they should be a pure representation of who you are, because if a lot of people fail at setting boundaries, and that's because they have nothing to do with who they are. They just read it on Instagram and are like, I'm going to set this boundary. So it has to be a genuine reflection of you. And it has two purposes, or for me, it holds like a purpose that's twofold. One is protection, one's connection.
The blueprint is interesting to me, because there's a metaphor that we used in an earlier episode where there was a guest who is a gestalt therapist like me. So she said, you know, in gestalt, everything is watched through the boundary, we call it the contact boundary between two beings. And she said, boundary between two people is something like a shore. It doesn't belong to the beach and it doesn't belong to the sea. And it's not the same all the time. It changes. And that's the important part, is which you said, the boundaries are not walls. Mm-hmm. I think people sometimes struggle putting up boundaries because it changes their, their idea of themselves. Mm-hmm. Says if I, reject something or decline or make myself unavailable, that will mean, and then insert any, their earlier beliefs, which is then I am a rude person, then I am not loving and caring and something like that.
Totally.
So once again, and the readers will now find out why is the self so important, because once again we come to the conclusion that it's very hard to have boundaries if you don't have a sense of self, if you don't know what you're putting boundary
around. Yeah.
And so one more thing about boundaries, very short, and then we'll move on to the next theme, is what I really liked about boundaries, which I think it will be useful for viewers, is you said that people sometimes, when they try new things, they are sometimes clumsy. They are sometimes not very, adept in finding the right balance. And you had an example of a client who didn't have any boundaries and then they became too rigid. And I think that it's important to for people to understand that it's okay when you try out new things, that it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be very, neat and organized, and everything doesn't have to fall into place.
It won't.
Immediately. It won't. Yeah. And it's okay to be, I don't know any other word than clumsy, but something like that. Not very beautiful at that.
I think life is messy.
Yeah.
And I think when our expectation is that it won't be messy, that's when we're in trouble. So it's like, you're going to make mistake. You're going to overcorrect. You're going to try a boundary. It's not going to work. You're going to think this is your sense of self and you're going to express it. And then you're going to realize that no longer aligns 10 years from now. And so thinking about it in terms of messy and fluid and playful, can be really, really helpful. Otherwise, you're going to beat yourself up. You're going to be like, I set a wrong boundary and I'm such a terrible person, or no one's going to love me. And I think just understanding, like, hey, it's a boundary. You can put it up, you can put it down, you can change it. Again, it's about just giving yourself some space to create, and grace that you're going to make a mistake. No matter how much you work on yourself, you're still going to make mistakes.
Yeah, I love the balance in your messages about, it's like everything is, like the combination of hard truths and gentle reminders. You say so many things that are probably uncomfortable at the beginning, but then with so much, care. And so we talked about loss of self, I think, quite enough now. So how do we get it back? I mean, it's what the book is about, but...
Yeah.
I'd like to tell you to say something about, is it possible and is it...
Of course it's possible, and it's never too late. And I think something to just remember is that your decisions that led you to become a person you don't want or like anymore are the same decisions that can change that, and you can become who you do want to become. What I mean is, don't make the same decision, but like you can make decisions, and it's about just being observant, so self-aware, and then intentional. If I was to boil down 10 chapters, and there's a lot of them,
okay,
it's like, become more intentional. Understand that every choice is an important choice. What that means is that every choice molds you a little bit. So are you going to have coffee or matcha? Are you going to meet up with a friend or not? Are you going to keep dating that person or not? Are you going to choose to have a child or not? Are you going to... And I think it's just important to take it seriously and make decisions that are responsible and that belong to you. And I think slowly over time, the self gets more created, more constructed, and more clear. I talk about how the self has the emotional self, the mental, and then the physical self. And what's easy and kind of fun is I get people to rank that, being like, which self are you most connected to and which are you the least connected to? So the one you're least connected to, start there. So if it's your physical self, you're like, I have no idea. Me and my body don't have a relationship. Start observing how the body language is when you're talking to someone you like or don't like, about sensations, about are you getting headaches always at the same time? Why is that? So becoming more aware of that part of you, if it's your emotions, identifying emotions, your beliefs around emotions. And so I kind of go through the three categories. But if you're listening, I guess it could just be fun for you to go, which self am I most connected to and which am I the least connected to?
Yeah, and what you said about, it again boils down to the self being ever-changing and never too stable. So every decision influences it. There's something else also from Gestalt, which we call the paradoxical theory of change, which means that we cannot force change. Mm-hmm. And in order to change, we need to become fully aware of what we are right now. And how we are right now.
Exactly.
So, and awareness is a central concept, I think, both in the book and in that theory, because you need to, pay attention to yourself in a way you didn't pay attention before.
Absolutely.
And I think that when you talk about, the physical self with our bodies, I think it's one of the areas we are, in our culture, the least encouraged to pay attention to. And there's so many people with unhealthy relationships with their bodies, and we don't listen to what our bodies have to say. We don't appreciate it. We think that when we are tired, we think, oh, I'll ignore it, this stupid body doesn't doesn't support me in a way it should. And as you said in the beginning of the book, when you described your panic attack, sometimes the body sends us the message when we don't want to hear it in any other way. And we cannot go against our body signals when it comes to that point, because the body is so powerful that you cannot run away from it.
Our body is so amazing. And I think part of the issue is that we think we own our body. Our body's a tool. Our body is something we trade. It's a currency, rather than understanding that the body is the self. So we devalue it. And in the book, I compare it to like going to the best heart surgeon in the world, being like, oh my God, I love your hair. And he's like, I just saved someone's life. Like, that's what we do with the body. We go like, wow, you look so nice. But your body is processing everything you've ever experienced. It holds your being quite physically. It is who you are. And I think until we realize that dynamic, we're going to have a hard time respecting what he has to say. Mm. So I didn't respect what he had to say. I wasn't listening to what he had to say. And then he yelled at me. And then I was so mad because I was like, how dare you yell at me? And how dare you control my life? And that's what he felt like. He felt like it was controlling my life. And now I look at it as it saved my life. Without that panic attack, I would have kept living my life exactly the same way. But it was like, oh, this girl is not going to stop. So I'm going to have to stop her. And I'm very, very grateful to my body.
You can't beat it when it wants to stop you.
Oh, you cannot do anything. Yeah. And I think it shows its true power in that moment.
Yeah, and I think besides our bodies being wise, they almost always tell us something. And what I see in people is when they don't have any, when they're on a cognitive level or an emotional level so disconnected from their experience, there often is something you can find in the body. There often is some sensation, whether it is, a stiff neck or a feeling in your stomach or something like that. It's almost always there's something, and it could be a good starting point.
Oh, absolutely. If I ever feel stuck with a client where they can't access anything, I'd be like, what does your body want to say? Or where do you feel it in your body? Or let's close our eyes and do a body visualization. And almost always something comes up. And so I always say, let's invite our body to the table. Let's make it a normal, routine part of the discussion instead of ignoring it, because it's kind of like a child too, in terms of the more you ignore it, the tantrums get louder. And that's what happened to me. I ignored my body for so long that eventually had to kind of scream at me.
Yeah, and I think there's also one of the things you mentioned, and it's also a technique that's used in Gestalt therapy, is giving voice to the body sensations. And that's when I say I feel, I don't know, maybe a burning sensation here or, a tightness in my stomach. Therapist could ask, what would that sensation say if it had a voice? Yeah, and
if your tears could speak, what would they say?
Yeah. And it's so powerful, you know, the reactions when you do any interventions with the body, the reactions are extremely powerful. And you had examples here about clients who were so out of touch with their emotions, and then when they came, you know, they reconnected with their body. It was overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely.
And okay, body is important, and we won't ignore our bodies. Okay,
good.
Yeah,
done.
And after the physical self, what I'd like to speak about is the emotional self, which you mentioned also. Emotions are also, I think, misunderstood pretty much all the time. Yeah, yes. And what I really liked is you wrote that there's always a reason for our emotions, mm-hmm. and I think it's people sometimes think it's a hard truth, but I find it so empowering. But people all the time say, I'm feeling like this or like that, or irritated or nervous or something. I have no idea why.
Yeah.
And they find it hard to accept that there is a why.
Yeah.
But for me, it was so comforting to know that I can't feel bad if there isn't a reason for that.
For sure. I think we've been taught that our emotions are irrational, that they are destructive, that they're going to lead us astray, and that we need to be really logical in order to make proper decisions.
You should always listen to logic and never to emotions.
And I think that narrative that's become so global is incredibly damaging, because your emotions are messengers. And they're incredibly important messengers. And I don't think we should ever make a decision 100% on our emotions. But I think there has to be a beautiful connection between rationale and emotion, in terms of the rationale at least taking responsibility for the emotion and whatever the emotion is trying to say. And so for me, a lot of my work is just getting clients to see value in emotion and to let go of any negative beliefs they have about it. And then I think it's like a beautiful thing of, I'm speaking to myself. Am I going to choose to listen or not? Yeah. And
Well, it's hard because we've been brought up and we've been fed beliefs that some emotions are inherently bad, you know. And I think I don't know many people who as children were encouraged to show anger or sadness. Yeah. But anger especially, you know, I wanted to talk about anger, because it's probably the most unjustly vilified emotion. It's something that's always associated with lack of control or something, or maybe even a sign that you are spoiled or something like that. But anger is very useful, and it's I don't know if you have any comment. I'm just speaking on top of my head.
It's so sad, especially for women. I find that we're not allowed to be angry ever. Because it's like, now you're hysterical, now you're irrational, now you're whatever, all the swear words, if a woman's angry. And so I find that super fascinating. And anger always has a reason. And I think it's filled with vitality, filled with, like, you usually get an adrenaline hit when you're angry. So that means it's like an embodied emotion. I mean, all are. But I think there's something really cool about anger, because you usually feel it in your entire body. And existentially speaking, I say we get angry for three reasons.
Okay.
One, we get angry when we feel threatened. Threat to self, particularly. Second is when our boundaries are being violated. And third, when our needs are not being met. So next time you're angry, ask yourself which of the three, if not all, is happening. Because that way you will see how your anger is trying to protect you. Now, anger is not an issue. The way we express anger can be an issue. So that evaluation gives you space to process and then choose how to respond to your feeling of anger. I don't think just because anger is a valid emotion does not give you an excuse
to
be
around
destructive.
And yell at people all the time. Yeah, of course. I think you described it beautifully as the interplay between emotions and rationality. We can, feel our emotions, and then the rational part of ourselves will choose our reaction, which should not be ignoring the emotion at all, all times, because the emotion is bad.
Exactly.
And, also in Gestalt, we have, Fritz Perls, the founder of Gestalt Therapy, also wrote a lot about anger and aggression, but not in a negative way. He says he spoke about He called aggression everything that it's reaching out and grabbing something from your environment. So it doesn't have to be destructive, you know. But he said also the role of anger, and in the context of the boundaries he spoke between us, anger makes it boundaries more visible. You know, it makes it, it solidifies them. And so that's it aligns with your examples, how we, when we, when our boundaries are being crossed, we get angry to, you know, it's a line in the sand. It says, exactly. Okay, no, no more.
And sometimes we don't even know we had a boundary until we get mad. And then we go, oh, that was a boundary. And I think that's so fascinating. Our anger can teach us so much.
Yeah. And it's all about awareness. It's all about, you know, being there and being present. And, I don't know, just, I don't know how to say it, but just pay attention to everything you feel and everything you think. And, you know, I don't think that it's possible to have any completely rational decision. Because
no, of course
it's
not.
Also, it's also a false dichotomy, like we spoke about body and mind and how it was also separated for a long time because it was easier to understand it at the time in that way. And I think it's the same with thoughts and emotions. We cannot completely separate them. There's also a pretty bad example of how we understand it from, there's a movie called Equilibrium. It's a sci-fi from the beginning of the century. And it's a dystopian society when emotions are forbidden. And there's like the main villain who's in at one point literally screaming at someone else, "I have no emotions." And it's, you know, it goes to show
so
how
good.
Yeah, how we, you know, don't understand emotions at all. And okay, so what I'd like to hear from you now, just before the end, a little, I say for my sake, some questions about existentialism. You mentioned Heidegger. He was your, you mentioned him somewhere as your favorite. And who else do you like? How do you, I mean, you mentioned Sartre a lot, and you mentioned Frankl a bit.
One of my favorite lines that they never cut, and I wrote it as a joke, and I was like, they're for sure going to edit this out, was my boy Sartre, because I mentioned him so much.
I don't know how they translated that.
I don't know either.
Okay, I'll look it up later.
But it's like clearly a joke in English, and that's because I kind of fell in love with him as I was as I was reading a lot, and as I was putting his ideas in my book, I was like, wait, we kind of vibe. It was similar. So yeah, Sartre, Kierkegaard, Heidegger are probably some of my biggest inspirations. I do like Camus as well, just was never as much into it. So I think you always pick favorites in the way that they write and present ideas. Viktor Frankl was huge, and then obviously his pupil, his student, Alfred Lange, who completely...
Yeah, he was a new name for me.
Yeah, and he's so chill and under the radar, and he's doing incredible work. He's the father of existential analysis. He was my doctoral supervisor, so he definitely had the greatest impact on my work
personally.
Yeah
You mentioned Camus. I think he's probably my favorite, and I find him incredibly optimistic, which no one around me does find.
That's me and Nietzsche. I find him so funny and kind of... Anyways, keep going.
No, okay. What I wanted to say is that there are so many beautiful existential pieces of art which people probably don't know that they are, you know, based in existential philosophy. I, you know, keep thinking about the movie Taxi Driver with Robert De Niro, which is you know, one of my favorite movies. And then I heard Martin Scorsese say, well, Taxi Driver is basically Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground. And I hadn't made that connection before.
Oh my gosh, you blew my mind.
I
love Dostoevsky.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I also love Dostoevsky. I think some of the, you know, I think even Freud said that you know, I didn't discover the unconscious. It was the poets and the writers and the philosophers who really knew the most about human soul. And while we read Dostoevsky, I think, you know, Brothers Karamazov, probably, you know, one of my favorite novels of all time. So much to say, so much to say about responsibility and about freedom and, you know, the relationship. You know, the anecdote when Jesus returns and is prosecuted in Spanish Inquisition, it's like, you know,
Amazing.
So, and for the end, I wanted to ask you, because you list out some of the recommendations for further reading.
Yes.
And there's, you know, maybe 10, 15 mm-hmm. of them. People often ask me who'd like to read mm-hmm. and don't have the habit of reading, so they need something that is you know, in light enough so that they can get into it, but has some substance. So what I'd like you is to give us some recommendations, what you would recommend to someone who would like to read more and doesn't have the discipline or the habit. And it doesn't have to be professional literature, but no novels. And of course, your book will be the first recommendation. Okay.
To be honest, I almost never recommend self-help books.
Okay.
I think for me, who changed my life was Dostoevsky and Hermann Hesse.
Okay.
I love him. And I read his work, like Damien, okay. whatever, however you want to say it. And that book came at such a right time for me. And I think those beautiful authors talked about existential topics sometimes better than anyone else ever will, including a self-help book. And I tried my best. And so I always say, why don't you read a novel with these themes? That's such a great way to get into it. So Damien from Hermann Hesse is one of my favorites. Notes from the Underground is an all-time high from Dostoevsky. So I always say, try getting into like the fiction from some of the old existentialists, the original existentialists, and see how that works for you. And then obviously this book is great.
Yeah, it is. The book I recommend the most, of course, Frankl's The Man's Search for Meaning,
of course.
Is so often. And the one, it's not existentialist really, but it does speak about some, you know, social influences on our behavior is The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm.
Oh my gosh, yeah, he's great. Yalom, how did we forget about Yalom?
Yeah, of course. What do you recommend from Yalom, people who never read him?
I don't know if you've never read him. I love Love's Executioner.
Okay.
What a great book. I think he's such a cool way to get, if you're uncomfortable with therapy, don't know what it's about. He really humanizes what it means to be a therapist in that exchange in the room. A lot of his work does that. And so it's why I gravitate towards him. And I honestly, anything he writes is pretty great. Yeah. So he makes it a story. And I think that's accessible.
Yeah, I don't know. I read somewhere that, you know, people who don't read his books for the existentialism, but who write it as purely novels, don't like his writing. They say he's a mediocre writer, but I say, who cares?
Who cares?
Because it's not about style with him.
It's not about style with him. And I think it really depends. I don't know. It's very easy to read, so I think maybe that's why people are like, but but if you're not a huge reader, that could be a really great entry point.
Of course. Okay, well, thanks. Thanks again very much.
Hvala vam puno.
Okay, hvala
moj
tebi.
Evo, se vraća.
Na kraju, samo još jedan put da podsjetim sve. Potražite knjigu Na meni je, Care Kuburić, u Harfa izdavačka kuća. Imam knjižarama širom Srbije. A vas, naše gledalce koji su došli do kraja epizode, pozivam da nas zapratite na našim društvenim mrežama, da se subscribeujete i da nastavite da nas verno pratite do sada.